So right off the bat, we're going to talk about sexuality, marriage, and singleness tonight. And I want to give credit where credit is due. Actually, Tim Keller gave a wonderful talk called Sex and Christian Hope, in which he used 1 Corinthians 6 and 7, and that really shaped my thinking on these issues. And so the first thing I want to point out, we're going to kind of deal with sex, marriage, and singleness in that order, but if you noticed, one of them was in the reading and one of them is at the beginning of chapter 7. Paul actually in this passage lifts up two views of sex. He lifts up two views of sex, both of which are wrong, and he holds them up and then he kind of explains what a biblical view of sex is. And I want to point those out first thing. The first is found in 6 verse 13 where we started reading. He says, "Food for the stomach and the stomach for food, but God will destroy them both." That seems like kind of an odd thing to lead off with in a discussion about sex. But it stems from this philosophy, it stems from this idea that came from, it was in Greek culture, but it was around before that too, and also much more widespread than the Greeks, because you find it in Hinduism and Buddhism and that sort of thing. In essence, it's the view that sex is just another appetite. Sex is just another appetite. It's natural, it's human, and so, you know, when you need sex or when you want sex, you just have sex with whomever you want, because frankly, the flesh isn't all that important. It's the spirit that we need to take care of. Anything that's material, anything that's body, you know, is going to pass away. You know, God will destroy them both the food and the stomach. Material things don't matter.
Would you consider that Gnosticism?
Gnosticism, Docetism, I suppose, more specifically. That separation of body and spirit, that it's the spirit that counts, that it's the spirit that lasts, that it's the spirit that needs to be taken care of. And actually, the second view of sex that Paul lifts up as incorrect is, it's kind of opposite, but it stems from this same way of thinking, this same separation of spirit and body. And we find that actually kind of indirectly in 7 verse 1. Where Paul says, "Now for the matters you wrote about, it is good for a man not to marry." It is good for a man not to marry. In other words, this is the view of sex, that it is, you know, it's a dirty thing, it's a defiling thing, and yes, you know, it's necessary for procreation, but a holy person should really stay away from it at all costs. And so Paul kind of lifts these two views of sexuality in the culture in which the Corinthians were living and says, you know what, both of these are missing the point. Both of these are wrong. So, you know, sex doesn't matter, that it's just a physical thing and what we do with our bodies doesn't really count in the long run, and that sex is an evil thing, it's a dirty thing, it's a defiled thing, so we should stay away from it completely. Neither one of those is the view that God wants us to have of sex.
That idea of separating body and spirit, mm-hmm. I think that's sort of seeped its way, it's a heresy that's seeped its way into the church in a number of ways. We sort of engage this, especially with the youth group, just a little bit, in thinking about heaven, talking about Revelation. How many Christians, if you closed your eyes and pictured heaven, how many of us, the first image we have is clouds, and we float around, and we have wings, because we think that heaven, if heaven's this glorious place, must mean we're spirit only, mm-hmm. right? We sort of separate it from the flesh. Well, that's from Plato. That's not Christian. That's not scriptural. And we have to sort of find a way to marry body and flesh again, because that's the way God created us, with body and spirit at creation, and that's the way that we're going to be in heaven too, because God called that very good. And we've pulled it apart.
Yeah, and Christianity actually is unique in world religions in that it is a bodily, fleshly religion. It's not just spirit. God created flesh and he created spirit, and they are intimately connected. and our eternal future is going to be with a body and a soul.
Yeah. Just an aside. Sorry.
Yeah. So these are the two views. Now, I wanted to ask you this, Zach. Do you think that those two views are still pretty prevalent in the world today?
Sure.
That sex is completely natural. You know, you just have it when you need it or want it. It doesn't really matter all that much. And that sex is a kind of a dirty thing that we want to stay away from.
In the church and outside the church.
Yeah.
I think we see it in both places. I think outside the church, it's sort of run rampant with this freedom, right? It's an appetite. You take what you need, right? And we've sort of seen the effects of that with some of the Me Too movement type things, right? It got too far, and now we're sort of trying to figure out, so what do we use now to rein that in? Right. We've thrown the Bible away, right? I'm talking about out in the world. We've thrown the Bible away as our guide for how sexuality works, and now we're realizing, boy, we're kind of in over our heads, and we don't know what moral code to live by anymore to rein that back in. I think in the church, you see the other side. I've talked with newly married couples and couples who've been married for a long time who've said it took them, in some cases, years to get over the dirty feeling that came with sex. And we've done married couples a disservice on that side of things too, because within the context of marriage, it's a beautiful thing and not a dirty thing anymore. And so we sort of erred in different ways.
Yeah. Somebody made the joke to me that that it's a political issue too, and that you can divide the view between red states and blue states. Blue states is, you know, sex is natural, just do it when you need it, do it when you want it, and red states are, you know, sex is dirty, you know, we should just stay away from it completely. What do you think, Terry? Okay. All right, let's get to the view that Paul actually holds up to marriage, or holds up of sex as it's applied to marriage.
How it ought to look.
Yeah, and I have written down 6 verse 18 here. Let me find that a second. Paul says, flee from sexual immorality. All other sins a man commits are outside his body, but he who sins sexually sins against his own body. Now, right off the top, that kind of sounds like Paul is agreeing with this second view that I mentioned. Doesn't it? Sounds like Paul is agreeing with that. But see, Paul uses a Greek word here, and it's porneia. And porneia applies to not just strict adultery, not just sex outside of marriage relationships, sex with another man's wife, sex with another woman's husband. Porneia actually is this broad sweeping thing that covers all sexual acts outside of a marriage relationship.
Yeah.
And so it applies to absolutely everyone, not just married men, not just married women, but singles and everybody.
And everything, it's the whole gamut of sex outside marriage. So the word porneia, obviously, is where we get pornography, mm-hmm. that's included, flee. It includes homosexuality. It includes promiscuity among singles, right? So you had said earlier there's a word for adultery. He didn't use that.
Right.
He went out of his way to use porneia, which applied not just to married people, but to singles and married.
Yeah. And so, you know, the key to understanding that is Paul's use of that word kind of holds marriage as that only right place and beautiful place to exercise our physical sexuality, right? So marriage is extremely important, and marriage is the only place where sex is appropriate.
Which is a connection to Genesis 2.
Genesis 2,
which tells us from the beginning that for this reason a man will leave his parents and be united with his wife, or a husband will leave his parents and be united with his wife. And Paul here in the New Testament is confirming that created sexuality between man and wife by saying in marriage is the only context for sex.
And it's a it's a it's held up in a very high regard.
Yeah.
Actually, Paul mentions that in verses 16 and 17. The two will become one flesh is the end of that verse in Genesis chapter 2.
Yeah, it's the quote.
And let me just find that a second. I have to turn pages here. What does Paul say? He says, "Do you not know that he who unites himself with a prostitute..." Now, prostitute here is not how we use it. A prostitute was any single person, actually. "Do you not know that he who unites himself with a prostitute is one with her in body? For it is said, the two will become one flesh." The two will become one flesh. So what Paul is doing here, what he is mentioning here, is that reference from Genesis 2, that a man shall leave his mother and father and be united with his wife and be one flesh. But here's the interesting thing. One flesh has to mean more than just physical union. It has to mean more than just the act of physical sex. Why do I say that? Because otherwise, in essence, what Paul is saying is, don't you know that when you have physical union with someone, you have physical union with them? It's redundant. It doesn't need to be said. And so Paul is talking about this one flesh principle in a much broader way, a much deeper way than just physicality, just the meeting of body parts. What would you think that he means there, Zach?
It goes beyond, I mean, there's an obvious physical benefit to sexuality, but there's a relational and a spiritual benefit to it as well. And so my guess is he's trying to pull body and spirit together, again, as a rejection of those other views, and say, hey, when you guys are united, you're united physically, yes, you're united relationally, like you can't achieve in different ways. You're united spiritually. My guess would be it's Paul pulling together body and spirit again,
yeah,
and saying that's what we're really talking about in sexuality.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think you're absolutely right. See, sex is a physical act that involves a complete self-giving of yourself to another person. It's complete vulnerability, it's complete commitment. And in essence, what Paul is saying here is he's saying, don't ever engage in the physical act of sex unless you are ready to give your whole life into another person's hands. It's total self-commitment. It's not just physical union, but it's legal union, and it's economic union, and it's spiritual union. And so Paul is holding up this extremely high view of sex. The world had never encountered a view of sex, and now putting it in the context of marriage, that is this high before.
Yeah.
I mean, Paul is just holding this up as something special and something just beautiful.
That's interesting, because I think the world would look at the Christian's understanding of sexuality and sex and say, you guys have this narrow understanding of what sexuality can look like, right? You guys, it's defined and it's this one thing, and we are the ones who have, you know, opened it up for all these different lifestyle choices, and we're the ones who have sort of found the sweet spot here. But really, what Paul's saying is, what the world's done is they've put themselves on one end of a spectrum, and in our world, it's, hey, it's an appetite, eat, right? And what Paul's saying is, it's way more than just this physical thing. And instead of being this narrow understanding of what sex and sexuality is, it actually becomes a really full understanding of what sex and sexuality can be.
Yeah, actually, I was just thinking about this. So I'm going to throw it out there, and if it works, it works. If it doesn't, it doesn't. I'm trying to think of kind of a concrete example of this. So Jenny and I have been married for 16 years, okay? So we have physical union, and, you know, we do our best to do the whole life commitment thing. You know, my body is hers, her body is mine. We are connected spiritually. We are on the same page. This maybe has something to do with headship too. But, you know, I'm thinking about what that relationship creates. And it actually has transformed me in a way. And let me explain. When something happens in my life, or, you know, something as simple as somebody tells me something or makes a statement, you know, because Jenny and I have this close, intimate relationship, in my response to whatever stimulus happens in my world, I have access not only to my own reaction and my own thoughts about whatever was said or done, I actually know exactly what Jenny would say or do in response to a given situation. And so, as a husband connected to my wife, I, for a split second, have an option as to how I will respond. You know, it gives more fullness. Marriage, with the right understanding, with the high understanding, with God's understanding, actually gives us more fullness in ourselves, right? There's this connection. And so that's, maybe that worked, maybe it didn't, but that's just something I thought of. Mm-hmm.
So what does that mean for singles? I mean, we've described this fullness and these benefits of marriage relationship. What does that mean for singles?
Well, obviously we've already discussed that sex outside of marriage is not what God has in mind. It's actually a destructive thing. So all of the benefits of sex and all of the benefits of marriage that we just quickly went through are going to be hindered, are going to be incapacitated if we are having sex outside of marriage. It actually destroys our ability to connect with someone else on that level. But yeah, what does that mean for singles? Actually, Paul has something kind of revolutionary to say about how this applies to singles too. And
is it revolutionary though?
It is.
Because it is. But at this point, Jesus has already modeled this. I mean, Paul's only asking for people to live the way Jesus lived.
Well, the way Jesus lived was revolutionary, and Paul is articulating it.
I think Jesus is the revolutionary.
Okay, fine. We'll give Jesus the credit.
All right.
Fine with me. Okay, we're good.
1-0.
Oh, jeez.
I'm kidding.
Anyway, well done. Okay. Consider me rebuked. Anyway, this is what Paul has to say to singles. And Zach read this before, but if you still have your Bibles open, 7 verse 27. He says, "Are you married? Do not seek a divorce. Are you unmarried? Do not look for a wife. But if you do marry, you have not sinned. And if a virgin marries, she has not sinned. But those who marry will face many troubles in this life, and I want to spare you this." Now, what Paul does here is he sets this up in such a way that he gives us the highest view of sex that history has ever seen. He gives us the highest view of marriage that history has ever seen. And then he says, but you know what? For Christians, you can do without either of them. It's not the most important thing. It's not the most important thing. And he goes on from there in verse 29. It says, "What I mean, brothers, is that the time is short. From now on, those who have wives should live as they had none." That doesn't mean that you should walk away from your marriages. It just means that your marriage should be put into perspective based on our Christian hope for an eternal future that God has planned for us. He goes on, "Those who mourn as if they did not, those who are happy as if they were not, those who buy something as if it was not theirs to keep, those who use the things of the world as if not engrossed in them, for this world in its present form is passing away." In essence, what Paul is saying is, you know, don't be too quick or too obsessed with changing your status. If you're married, don't be fantasizing about not being married. And if you're single, don't be too quick to get married. Don't hold marriage up as some kind of an end in itself, like it's some kind of an idol in your life, because frankly, all that's good about sex and all that's good about marriage and all that's wonderful about the freedom of singleness to have a relationship with Jesus Christ without distraction, all of these things point to our future hope.
Yeah.
And the way Tim Keller puts it is, it is hope in our ultimate family, and it is hope in our ultimate lover, who of course is Jesus Christ.
Do you think we've made marriage an idol?
Oh yeah.
I think so too.
In traditional societies, it's funny, because in traditional societies, everything was family oriented. So all of your identity, all of your honor, all of your accomplishments, those were all done on behalf of the family. Family was the most important thing. So there was unbelievable pressure for people to get married, because if you didn't get married and if you didn't have kids, you had no significance in life. As a matter of fact, Caesar Augustus actually levied a tax on widows who did not remarry within 2 years of their husband's death.
Huh.
I mean, it was even oppressive toward people that were not married.
Wow.
But today we have something different.
Yeah.
Today, at least, well, in the church we still have the family thing, but in the world around us, in secular culture, it's not so much the family that gives you significance, but part of our own individual coming of fulfillment. Think about the pressure to find your true love.
Yeah.
Like there's this pressure that, you know, we all have to find our true love, our soulmate. And if we don't find our true love and our soulmate and get married or be together with that person, we've somehow kind of failed in life. And, you know, thanks Walt Disney in some ways.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's a little bit different situation now than it was then, but it's still idolatry.
Yeah.
It's still misguided.
It's funny how often we, and it's just a throw-in, but when we talk about people's future, I mean, how many parents are putting pressure on kids? You know, find a spouse and get me grandbabies, or a kid's going away. I mean, even at Baccalaureate today, it was a beautiful service, but it was about relationships. And about how to foster a good relationship when they go away. Like it was just assumed that the next step in life for you is finding a spouse.
Yeah.
And we just hold that up like it's a goal.
Yeah.
And Paul says it's not a goal. I think he uses the word in here, I say this as a concession or something like that. He says like you don't need to be married.
Right.
The gospel message is just as true for a single person as it is for a married person, and Jesus found fullness and fulfillment in a single life, and Paul found fullness. Verse 40 we didn't read, but 39 and 40, it's like, I think he's trying to be funny. He says, a woman is bound to her husband as long as he lives, but if her husband dies, she is free to marry anyone she wishes, but he must belong to the Lord. In my judgment, this is Paul, in my judgment, she is happier if she stays as she is. And I think that I too have the Spirit of God, which I think is Paul saying, look, I'm single. I have the Spirit of God.
Yeah.
I don't need to be married to have the Spirit of God. I have access to the spiritual gifts that married people have access to. I have access to the fullness of life that married people have. So I think it's Paul saying, like, hey, look, I'm doing just fine.
Yeah.
I'm single. I have a full life. I find my fulfillment in Christ and Christ alone. I'm able to do things. I'm able to live recklessly and go into these places where they're saying, Paul, if you preach the gospel one more time, we're going to flog you. And he goes, I got no one waiting for me at home. Go ahead, right? And Paul's able to do some of these things and travel like crazy. If you've ever seen a map of Paul's missionary journeys, I mean, the guy was on the road his whole life. And those are things, I mean, I don't know if it's 1st or 2nd Corinthians, he writes to the people and says, did I ask anything of you when I was preaching to you? He wasn't taking offerings. He wasn't always being able to work. That's things that married people have to consider. And I think that's why Paul looks at it and says, if I was married, I couldn't do the ministry I'm doing. It would be a hindrance to me, really. And he says, I too, hey, look, I have the Spirit of God. I'm doing just fine. I'm doing the Lord's work as a single person. My life is full. I think that's important to note.
Yeah. And so with one fell swoop, Paul demolishes the idolatry of family, family in inordinate, you know, significance, and he completely abolishes, you know, the importance of romantic love, otherwise your life won't be fulfilled, because ultimately we are going to find perfect joy and satisfaction in our eternal family, the communion of saints, and we are going to find perfect fullness and perfect joy and pleasure in our ultimate lover, Jesus Christ. And so, yes, what happens on earth circumstantially does not matter, not in the long run.